As we move away from the Sermon on the Mount, as we've seen, we see in verse 1 of chapter 8 that Jesus comes down from the mountain that he went up at the beginning of the sermon in chapter 5, and great multitudes followed him. So the multitudes that were with him in chapter 4 and that he tried to get away from at the beginning in chapter 5, they must have joined him at some period between chapter 5 and the end of chapter 7. And so now they're following him. What we have in this section from chapter 8 right the way through until nearly the end of chapter 9 is a very fast-moving section where we have stories, many of them, especially in chapter 8, that deal with things that happen in one day, which highlight Jesus' healings, and also we get to see the increased friction between Jesus and the religious leaders. And so let's have a look at that as we move into chapter 8. Chapter 8, verse 2, "And behold, a leper came and worshipped him, saying, Lord, if you are willing, you can make me clean." Now this is the first time since the adoration of the Magi that somebody is said to worship Christ. The verb that's being used here, proskunine, which has to do with doing obeisance to. But, of course, it depends on who is being obeyed, who one is presenting oneself before. And the idea that Jesus is the divine king, which is prominent in Matthew, means that this ought to be translated here as worshipped, which is what most versions do. So the leper comes and he worships him. He understands something of who he is, so he calls him Lord, and he understands something of his power, of his ability. If you are willing, you can make me clean. This is a very interesting way of presenting the issue, isn't it, to Jesus? In other words, what the leper is doing is putting the problem in the will of Jesus, the Lord, in the will of the healer. He's saying, if you want to, you can heal me. Showing him, not just he's taking his abilities as a healer for granted, he calls him Lord, he does obeisance to him, but at the end of the day, he's showing that he has faith in the person of Jesus. Now, the question is, what does Jesus want to do? Verse 3, "Then Jesus put out his hand and touched him, saying, I am willing, be cleansed. Immediately his leprosy was cleansed." Now what's fascinating about verse 3 is that Jesus touches the leper. Now, the leper had probably not expected this at all. The leper had not expected that his Lord would even touch him, a leper. You weren't supposed to touch lepers, but Jesus, you see, is showing that his lordship and his power to heal are also part of his character as a loving savior, as a compassionate Lord. And so showing that compassion, he touches this human being. He touches this person who he's created. You see, none of us are clean in God's sight. All of us are spiritual lepers, but all of us matter to him. Christ died for everyone. God sent his Son into the world to die for all of us, not just the ones who are healthy, bright examples of humanity, but for the lowliest of society. Jesus is willing, and he shows his willingness by touching the leper. Now, this leper has probably not been touched, at least by a clean human hand, for many years. And so the sense of aloneness and separation and isolation from the rest of the world was great for a leper in the ancient world. So again, this touch of Jesus shows that Jesus is accepting him as a human being. And God does that. God has created us with intrinsic worth. Let's always remember that. Even the worst people have intrinsic worth because they are in the image of God, however fallen and sinful they may be. And this is a great example here of the Lord himself leading the way. And immediately it says the leprosy was cleansed. It just went away. See, Jesus has the ability to rectify all of the ills, all of the wrongs that man has plagued creation with. Whether they be diseases, or whether they be wickedness, or the results of sin on the world, Jesus, when he returns, can sort it out. And Jesus, even now, because he's our Lord, he's our intercessor, he is looking interestedly at what we're doing in the world. He does sympathize with our trials, with our difficulties, with the things that we go through. And we ought to understand that he's a compassionate Lord. We ought to go to him in prayer, knowing that if he's willing, he can put it right. Now, sometimes he's not willing because there is some greater purpose, there is some other thing in this sinful and fallen world that is of greater value or of more importance in eternity than to heal our present troubles. And so we have to do like the Apostle Paul did. We have to glory in our infirmities. We have to rest in the grace of Christ, knowing that his grace is sufficient for us, knowing that God does care and he does know. Verse 4. Jesus said to him, "See that you tell no one, but go your way, show yourself to the priest, and offer the gift that Moses commanded as a testimony to them." You see, he wanted it made clear in what he was doing that his ministry was not contradicting the word of God in the Old Testament and the commandments which somebody who had been cleansed from leprosy was under according to the law of Moses. And so he told this person to present himself to the priest as cleansed, but cleansed by Jesus. That way they would know, first of all, how this person was cleansed, and secondly, that the cleanser, the healer, Jesus, was not against the law of Moses. Now, verse 5, when Jesus had entered Capernaum, a centurion came to him, pleading with him. So, this is a Roman centurion, saying, "Lord, my servant is lying at home, paralyzed, dreadfully tormented." And Jesus said to him, "I will come and heal him." He didn't have to come and heal him, just as he didn't have to touch the leper. But Jesus accommodates us. Most people would have expected Jesus to come with them. And so Jesus, in a sense, is taking that for granted and has said, "I'm going to come with you." But the centurion shows the measure of his faith, which draws out the will of Jesus on behalf of the centurion in healing the servant. Verse 8, the centurion answered and said, "Lord, I am not worthy that you should come under my roof." Now, he really didn't believe that. If this was just flattery or feigned humility, Jesus would have seen right through it. So obviously, when he says he's not worthy, he understands who Jesus is and understands who he is in relation to the Lord. And so he says, "But only speak a word and my servant will be healed. For I also am a man under authority, having soldiers under me, and I say to this one, 'Go,' and he goes, and to another, 'Come,' and he comes, and to my servant, 'Do this,' and he does it." Now, what the soldier is illustrating is his faith and the matter-of-factness of his faith. The soldier understands that Jesus is sent by God himself. That's what he's been proclaiming. And so the centurion is quite assured in his mind that with that kind of authority, Jesus just needs to speak the word and it will be done. So Jesus, verse 10, when he hears it, marvels and said to those who followed, "Assuredly, I say to you, I have not found such great faith, not even in Israel." Why does Jesus marvel? Doesn't he know what the centurion's going to do? Well, we have to remember that Jesus limited himself when he became incarnate as a man. In other words, this self-imposed limitation of certain divine attributes, which were his and which were never taken away from him, is what makes him a real man and what makes him a real example for us. He's not a pseudo-man. Jesus is a real man. And therefore, there was a limitation in his humanity on his knowledge. And so this marveling of Jesus that we read about in verse 10 is a real marveling. Jesus is surprised by the faith of this man. And so he says, I've never seen this, not even in Israel. Israel have a past of God's dealing with them. The Messiah is the Jewish Messiah. They have the promises and the covenants given to them. But here is this outsider, and this outsider is demonstrating faith in the Messiah of Israel and the God of Israel that no Israelite has shown. So verse 11, I say to you that many will come from east and west, those are the outsiders like the centurion, and sit down with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob in the kingdom of heaven. But the sons of the kingdom will be cast out into outer darkness. There will be weeping and gnashing of teeth. Now, this is not saying that God is going to be all through with the Jews. That's the way that it's often interpreted, particularly with the forms of replacement theology. And I call it replacement theology because that's what they're doing. They like to call themselves expansionists nowadays, but you don't expand something by altering it. You expand it by expanding it. In other words, you keep it the same, but you add things to it. Well, when you say that the nation of Israel is no longer party to the covenants that were made to them in the Old Testament, I mean literally with the land and so on, then you are changing, you are altering something, you're not expanding it. But of course we live in days where words are often changed and subtly used so as to imply something that they actually are not saying. And it's very sad that Christians involve themselves in that kind of verbal subterfuge. Now, what is being said here? What's being said is simply something that you find in the Old Testament itself, particularly in the covenants. And that is that the nations will also be blessed in Abraham. Notice you don't just have Abraham himself, though. You have the three patriarchs, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. These are the three patriarchs of Israel, the nation being spoken of. And so this is a very important eschatological passage because he's talking about the end times here, isn't he? He's saying that many will come from east and west and sit down with these three fathers in the kingdom of heaven. Here, the kingdom of heaven must be interpreted as the literal future kingdom upon earth. That's certainly the way that it would be taken by Jewish readers. Now this means not that in the kingdom there won't be an Israel, or Israel will be composed of Jews and Gentiles. He's not saying that at all. He's just saying that foreigners will come down and sit with the fathers of Israel. They're still the fathers of Israel, but foreigners will come and mix with them in the kingdom. This shouldn't surprise us, because if we've been saved by the same God, then whatever promises may or may not have been covenanted with us, and that we may be the recipients of, we're still human beings, and we will still interact as a family of human beings in the consummation. So verse 12, about the sons of the kingdom, who are Israelites in the context, being cast out, this is speaking, isn't it, of Jews who do not have faith in their own Messiah. They will be cast out. It's not saying all Jews will be cast out. Not at all. But just a solemn pronouncement of the doom of many unbelieving Jews. Now, by the way, we could figure that out if we turned to Matthew 13:38, where the term the sons of the kingdom is given not a negative connotation, as it is in this text, but a positive connotation. It speaks about the saved. And again, in the context, it has to do, I believe, with Jews. So not all Jews, not all sons of the kingdom, are going to be thrown out. The phrase weeping and gnashing of teeth, which is used 6 times in Matthew's Gospel, should probably be interpreted via Psalm 112, verse 10, which reads, "The wicked will see it and be grieved. He will gnash his teeth and melt away. The desire of the wicked shall perish." And this has to do here with the introduction of righteousness and the exaltation of the righteous in the kingdom. And so interpreted that way, this weeping and gnashing of teeth has got to do with the expectation of the wicked to go on in their ungodly ways and seeing that it actually has been terminated by the righteous God, and that the righteous, who they despised, they are the ones who are going to be blessed. They are the ones who are going to be happy and get the things that the wicked want but shan't have. So this has to do with regret, I think, more than physical pain. Verse 13, then Jesus said to the centurion, go your way, and as you have believed, so let it be done for you. And his servant was healed that same hour. It's interesting, isn't it, that Jesus takes the opportunity of the centurion's faith to make a comment about faith in him, and then just simply turns and tells the centurion that he can go, that his servant has been healed. Jesus didn't even say any words. He just said it's been done already while we've been talking. Verse 14. Now when Jesus had come into Peter's house, he saw his wife's mother lying sick with a fever. So Peter here is shown as being married. There's nothing wrong with being married. Jesus chose married men just as he chose unmarried men. So he, Jesus, touched her hand and the fever left her and she arose and served them. Wouldn't that be nice? If we had the flu or something like that, and when we're feeling very weak and just bedridden, somebody came in with that kind of power to not only take the fever away, but to infuse strength and vigor within us. That's what Jesus did here. When evening had come, they brought to him many who were demon-possessed, and he cast out the spirits with a word and healed all who were sick. So this means here that demon possession is not sickness, and not all sickness is caused by demon possession. I hope you can see that. There is a distinction that's made here. But demon possession was and is real. Jesus has power not just to deal with one demon-possessed person and then pack it in for the night, but to deal with all who were demon-possessed and just deal with them with amazing speed and authority. And then Matthew brings in a quotation from Isaiah, that it might be fulfilled which was spoken by Isaiah the prophet, saying, he himself took our infirmities and bore our sicknesses. And the kind of fulfillment that's being spoken of here is a direct fulfillment, isn't it? Jesus is taking people's infirmities upon himself. It's as if in touching these people and healing these people, he's taking that sickness away. And doing it through his person. It's not that he's becoming sick, that the sickness is traveling from the sick person to Jesus and then going away. It's just that Jesus, in the glory and power of his person, is taking the sickness away from the world in the case of that individual. And when Jesus saw great multitudes about him, he gave a command to depart to the other side. And then a certain scribe came and said to him, teacher, I will follow you wherever you go. And so we're going into this little section where the test of discipleship is being spoken of. We see this in more clarity in Luke 9. So how does Jesus answer this individual? I will follow you wherever you go. This person sees what Jesus is doing. He sees the amazing things that Jesus is doing. He probably hears the teachings of Jesus. And he's going to commit himself to following Jesus. But Jesus says, look, you need to understand, following me is no bed of roses. Foxes have holes, birds of the air have nests, but the Son of Man has nowhere to lay his head. In other words, if you follow me, if you come after me, you've got to give everything up. You won't even have a place to rest your head. You're going to be sleeping in the wild. Then another of his disciples said to him, Lord, let me first go and bury my father. But Jesus said to him, follow me and let the dead bury their own dead. Now, of course, this word of Jesus has occasioned much discussion. What is being said here? Now, to get a sense of what's going on here, I want to read a bit of the commentary by Donald Hagner, volume 1, page 217, where Hagner says, quote, in fact, so important is the commitment to honor one's parents that to fail in any of the following responsibilities is to be untrue to the Torah. To bury a father who has just died, to participate in the 6 days of official mourning after such a death, to look after one who is sick and perhaps near death, and to provide for an aging parent who may yet live many years. From the standpoint of the call to discipleship, the longer the delay involved, the more reasonable Jesus' negative reaction becomes. But the call to discipleship is for Jesus an absolute one that need not satisfy any normal canons of responsibility. Jesus' call in this case supersedes even strict obedience to the commandment of the Torah. Now Hagner also helpfully calls attention to what the would-be disciple says. He says, "Let me first go and bury my father." Do you know that? Let me first go. In other words, before I can follow you, before I will follow you, I must do this. This must be a priority. And Jesus will not accept discipleship on those terms. To follow Jesus is a strong commitment, and it is the first priority. And this story actually fits the context of the stories that we've seen. They both included faith in Jesus as Lord. And so if someone is to be a disciple, a follower of Jesus, then they must follow him as he is, as Lord, and therefore as one who is above the normal commandments upon men. He must come first, and if you can't put him first, then you cannot be his disciple. Now, of course, that was in the context of Jesus living in Israel 2,000 years ago. We should be careful in our application of verses like this today. But there is still an urgency in discipleship. Discipleship means commitment. In fact, that's the first bit of what discipleship entails. And so when he says, "Let the dead bury their own dead," could have meant, "Let the spiritually dead," in other words, those who are not interested in my teaching, "let them take care of those duties." And I think that's a good interpretation. Or it could have been understood in the context of saying, others will have to take care of that if you want to be my disciple. In other words, make other arrangements. And I think either of those fit the context here. And then we move on to the story of Jesus stilling the waves. Verse 23. "Now when he got into a boat, his disciples followed him, and suddenly a great tempest arose on the sea, so that the boat was covered with the waves, but he was asleep." It's not surprising he was asleep. Look at all the work he'd been doing. "Then his disciples came to him and awoke him, saying, 'Lord, save us, we are perishing.' And he said to them, 'Why are you fearful, O ye of little faith?'" Now, some of these people, remember, were fishermen. That means they were aware of the trouble that they were in. Others were not fishermen, but they would have known many stories of these storms that arose in the Sea of Galilee, and that could be very dangerous. And they would know that, for all intents and purposes, it looked like they were in serious trouble. So what is Jesus doing here? Rebuking them. "Why are you fearful, O ye of little faith?" Now, what is Jesus doing? What he's doing is something that we've got to grasp, and this is one of the best texts in the whole Bible for learning this important lesson. And the lesson is this: faith comes before knowledge, or faith comes before understanding. If these disciples had had faith in Jesus, who had said he was going to go to the other side, and had reminded themselves of who it was who was in the boat with them, they would not have feared, even though it looked as though they were in real peril. But of course they didn't. They just hung on to human knowledge. And because they put understanding and experience before faith, they feared. And we can do the same. When we're in difficult circumstances, whatever those circumstances may be, and we judge those circumstances from our finite and weak standpoint, we will be overwhelmed by them. We will feel powerless and oppressed by them. But faith, you see, interprets things differently because it sees God in circumstances, and it knows God is far greater than any circumstance that may meet us. And therefore, faith causes us to be calm even when others fear. And many Christians have been like this. Remember the Moravians who were on board ship as John Wesley crossed the Atlantic to go to America. They were in a storm and everybody was panicking. Everybody was fearful apart from these believers who just sang hymns to God. They understood that God was in control. So Jesus first rebukes the disciples for their lack of faith. Then he arose and rebuked the winds and the sea, and there was a great calm. So the men marveled, saying, "Who can this be that even the winds and the sea obey him?" Now they'd seen diseases and demons obey him. Now they see the natural elements obey him. So their appreciation of him as Lord rises to a new level. And then when they reach the other side, verse 28, they come to the country of the Gergesenes. Some New Testaments read Gadarenes, and you can find that on a map. Where there they met two demon-possessed men coming out of the tombs, exceedingly fierce, so that no one could pass that way. These are not just madmen, these are demon-possessed men. Now, Mark has a longer account of this, although he speaks of only one man. So it appears as though one man is doing the talking, and one man is prominent and the other not in the account. But here there are two. Verse 29, "Suddenly they cried out, saying, 'What have we to do with you, Jesus, you Son of God? Have you come here to torment us before the time?'" Now, this is not the men crying out. These are the demons inside the men who recognize who he really is, that he's the Son of God. And notice they call him Jesus. They equate the name Jesus with the second person of the Trinity. They know that they're judged. They know that torment awaits them. But they're hoping they have a bit longer to go. When Jesus shows up, the demons quake. And then the narrative goes on in verse 30. "Now, good way off from them, there was a herd of many swine feeding, and you had many pigs who were reared on that side of the Sea of Galilee." Some of them, by the way, by Jews. So the demons begged him, saying, "If you cast us out, permit us to go away into the herd of swine." This does not mean, by the way, that pigs are more likely to be infested with demons than other animals. I know that's what some teachers imply, but that isn't implied by the text at all. These pigs just happened to be there, and they knew they were going to get cast out of these men, so they wanted to go into other bodies. Verse 32, "And he said to them, 'Go.' So when they had come out, they went into the herd of swine, and suddenly the whole herd of swine ran violently down the steep place into the sea and perished in the water." Now notice it's the whole herd that's doing this. I don't know much about pigs, but maybe they went into just a couple of pigs and a couple of pigs ran down and caused a stampede of swine to go into the water. But it's probable that the many demons that were in the men went into the individual pigs that were there, and the pigs reacted by running down into the sea. Whatever, the pigs perished. "Then those who kept them fled, and they went away into the city and told everything, including what had happened to the demon-possessed men. And behold, the whole city came out to meet Jesus. And when they saw him, they begged him to depart from their region." They did not want anything to do with Jesus and his teaching and his salvation. They were superstitious, they were scared of what they'd seen or heard, and they just wanted Jesus to go and leave them at peace. And so that is what Jesus did, although we read that he passed by there later on. Now, before we leave chapter 8, let's just return to verse 20, where the term the Son of Man is used for the first time by Matthew. Son of Man, especially in a gospel like Matthew, which has such a strong Jewish and Old Testament association, must certainly be seen as an identification by Jesus himself with the great messianic figure of Daniel chapter 7. And that fits in with the kingdom language and the eschatological language of the kingdom that we see in this chapter. So with that said, we can now go on to the healing of the paralytic in Matthew 9.